KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Inner Richmond, Lower Haight,
Burlingame.
Coming up, we'll hear about a big change in the Cal State University system. The goal? To boost graduation rates.
You can come to this college, but you're not really ready to be here, so you're going to have to take these classes that don't get you anywhere.
Reinventing remedial education. And a longtime writer and activist of color speaks on the need for optimism in the face of history.
We, you know, as people of color, cannot afford to be cynical. You have to have, like, tenacious faith that things change.
And gospel singers talk about the spirit that moves them.
The excitement that I get right before they call our name. I mean, it's like a little nervousness, but as soon as they say the Sons of the Soul Revivers, oh, all that is gone.
Staying inspired today on Cross Currents. Earlier this month, the Cal State University Chancellor announced something huge. He issued an executive order that'll radically change what's known as remedial education. Right now, nearly 40% of incoming Cal State students bomb out on placement tests. They're supposed to measure their written communication and math skills. So instead of starting out in English and math classes that count towards graduation, they're steered into remedial non-credit courses. But those are backfiring for plenty of students. They get stuck there, they get discouraged, and they drop out. Chancellor Timothy White's order tells the 23 Cal State campuses to get rid of those placement tests and change up the coursework so students can start earning credits right away. Here to talk with me about those changes is KALW's education reporter, Lee Romney. So it sounds like this is a huge change. Why did the chancellor do it?
Well, it turns out it's part of this bigger initiative to boost graduation rates and speed up graduation by 2025. So they want to double the four-year grad rate.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2015, that rate was only about a fifth of students.
Graduated.
In four years. So they want to double that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also an achievement gap for minority and low-income students, and they want to completely eliminate that. And so last year they brought on board this guy from the Obama Department of Ed, James T. Minor, to mm-hmm. be a strategist and help figure out, you know, how they were going to get there. And he is really into this idea of getting rid of the placement tests and getting rid of remedial ed. And
uh-huh.
he actually thinks it's going to have an enormous, his word, enormous effect on college affordability.
How?
Well, students who get tracked into these courses are not earning credits right away, and sometimes they get stuck and they have to take them one, two, three times, and they're blowing through their financial aid while they're doing that.
And getting no credits.
And then getting no credit towards uh-huh. their graduation. And so, you know, they get discouraged, they drop out, it stretches out the amount of time they have to spend, and it turns out that the placement tests that they are getting rid of have been particularly bad for minority students. The numbers are kind of startling, but for African-American students, more than half fail and end up in remedial ed. And for Latino students, it's a little bit under half.
Right. And so if not placement tests, then what?
So the idea is to go to multiple measures and not be relying on just one thing. So high school GPA, you know, whether they took any AP or collegiate level courses, and how they performed on the kinds of standardized tests that you have to take when you're in high school.
Mm-hmm. SATs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. SATs, ACTs, the state exams that are supposed to kind of measure achievement. And, you know, individually, I don't think any of those are great either. But the idea is to take a bunch of these measures into consideration together.
Mm-hmm. And to kind of form a more holistic idea of who the person is.
Right.
Academically.
Yep.
What about the people who do need those remedial classes?
Yeah, that's the big change. And it's huge. You know, it's a change to curriculum, which is, it's a serious thing to undertake. But, you know, just so you know, most of this kicks in fall 2018. So there's a year to figure all this stuff out, but there's still a lot of concern about how it's going to work.
Are they going to tailor them to these students individually, or how does that work?
Well, so the students will be earning credit right from the get-go, and that's good. And they'll be in classes with people at different levels. But the idea is, you know, that they're going to have to do a little bit more, you know, and that can look different depending on the school. One way might be they have to spend extra time in the classroom That's one way. And then there's something called stretch courses.
Stretch courses.
Stretch,
yeah. What's that?
It's basically extending the class. So for people who need it, they would maybe have two quarters rather than one. Mm-hmm. But they're still earning credits. And so that's supposed to basically keep them sort of moving in the direction of graduation.
And motivated and encouraged. Is that like a part of it also? Just like we believe in you?
Yeah.
Like just psychologically?
No, I think it really is. I mean, the places that have tried this, you know, they've seen like a big boost in overall success that students are even, at least in some places like Tennessee, they've seen that students are doing better on their other classes mm-hmm. and they're less likely to drop out. So I think it really is discouraging to get admitted to college and be told from the get-go, well, you can come to this college, but you're not really ready to be here. So you're going to have to take these classes that don't get you anywhere.
Right, right. So where else has this worked? You mentioned Tennessee.
Yeah, well, you know, interestingly, some Cal State campuses are even experimenting with stretch courses already. So mm-hmm. that's a good thing to know. This isn't a completely new thing for them. Many of them have that in English. And about 7 campuses, actually, of the 23, have math stretch courses. Mm-hmm. And so they've done a little bit themselves. But as far as like a wholesale shift, I mentioned Tennessee, and that's actually an interesting example. A couple of years ago, the Board of Regents there, they tested out the similar model, but for the community college system. And what they had found was that this really, really low percentage of students who were in the remedial math and English courses were actually getting through those courses and passing a 4-credit class. And it was actually, for math, it was an 1/8 of students.
Wow.
But after they made the changes, and they put them in these students into courses where they got that extra support, 2/3 of them were passing the credit courses.
Oh, wow.
So that was huge. And, you know, and minority students, they had even greater gains than that.
So it sounds like it's a solution to what's been a real problem. What do faculty think about all of this? Mm-hmm. The people who are going to be teaching
yes.
these new classes and these kind of individualized classes.
Well, they feel a little blindsided, is what I learned. Mm. I think that, you know, the Cal State administration and the chancellor in some memos that he put out said, you know, they crafted this executive order with significant guidance and feedback from faculty and that there was robust discussion. Those are his words. You know, and there probably are faculty who are very much on board, but the folks I talked to felt that this was kind of jammed through without enough true input from faculty, especially considering that these are changes to curriculum. And then the union, the California Faculty Association, they're worried about a lot of teachers actually losing classes and being sort of out of the system altogether. And they're also worried about the students and if they're going to get the help they need, what the demands are going to be on faculty who are already super overextended. Are they going to have to be basically tutors on the side for, you know, 20 students in every class? They just don't know. And they're really concerned. One mathy guy, he's actually teaches accounting and finance. He's on the Academic Senate. And he's really worried that the classes are going to get dumbed down, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he, you know, his feeling is, yeah, graduation rates are important. But what's more important are the tools that we are giving students when they leave.
So it sounds like it's going to be hard to implement this if faculty is not 100% on board and happy.
Well, I think that is true. And there are probably a lot of, I don't want to say fights, but there's going to be discord and disagreement. But the bottom line is it's happening. And, you know, the order is out there and remedial classes are going away. So the schools are going to have to figure out a way to make it work.
Lee Romney is KLW's education reporter. There's a bill currently moving through the state legislature that would bring a similar policy to the state's community colleges. Find more information at kalw.org, click Cross Currents. And if you've got an education story you'd like us to report, email her at education@klw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Oakland-based Cherie Moraga is a Chicana poet, essayist, playwright, and feminist activist. She may be best known for This Bridge Called My Back, the anthology of writings by women of color that she co-edited with Gloria Anzaldúa back in 1981. But her body of work extends much further, and she's been steadily writing and producing plays since the mid-80s. Her newest, The Mathematics of Love, is currently running at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. It takes place in a hotel lobby in Los Angeles at the turn of this century, where Peaches, an older Mexican woman, has a time-traveling encounter with La Malinche, the controversial Mexican historical figure. Cherie Moraga spoke with KALW's Jen Chien to talk about her take on La Malinche and about liberating ourselves from 500 years of history.
So tell me about the genesis of this play, The Mathematics of Love. I understand it came out of a collaboration between you and the playwright Ricardo Bracho. Is that right?
Yes. It came out of a larger collaboration, actually, several years ago. Diane Rodriguez had this idea about collecting. She's worked, for many years in Los Angeles as a director, and she had this idea of putting together this performance play piece on the subject of amor eterno, so eternal love. And she selected about 8 playwrights and asked each of us to write a 10-minute play. So I did it, but I don't know how to write a 10-minute play, so I wrote a half-an-hour play. And it was with these two characters, Peaches and Papa, and waiting for God to arrive. And God was their son, you find out. That title was Waiting for the God, right? So Ricardo Bracho, who's down in L.A., he wrote a play, a 10-minute play, for the love of country, and that was with the character of Malinche. So Malinche has a very, kind of complicated and problematic history in terms of the history of Mexico, because she was the basically the concubine, the slave concubine and mistress of Hernán Cortés, who is the conquistador that, basically saw to the loss of indigenous Mexico. It's a long thing to say all of this, but that figure has been a very controversial figure, particularly for women, Chicanas, and also for Chicana feminists, because basically this person, Malinche, this figure in Mexicana imagination then and in culture has been related to basically being a kind of Mexican Eve, where the loss of Mexico...
A traitor to her culture.
Yes, and so she's considered sort of like... She carries this burden of having, lost Mexico to indigenous Mexico to the conqueror, right? So all that's to say is that Ricardo writes this 10-minute play where Malinche ends up, in the Biltmore Hotel in this missionary. So it's all this kind of play with time. And I loved it because she has the capacity to time travel. I go, oh, that's really interesting.
The light bulb went on.
Yes, because my character, Peaches... has Alzheimer's. So I just said to Ricardo, can I have your play? Not have it, but he is also publishing it independently. But
can I use it as material?
Yeah, and we're very good, he's my compadre. So that was the beginning of the play.
I want to return to the figure of La Malinche. And I'm wondering, just in your own life, what's been your relationship with her and how do you connect to her?
So what happened is that I was already here in San Francisco, and I guess I was in my mid-20s, and I went, it was before This Bridge Called My Back.
Which is your seminal feminist of color book that you're very well known for.
Which I co-edited with Gloria Anzaldúa. And I went to this conference, and this Chicana feminist scholar, Norma Alarcón, was reading this paper on Malinche, and she started to read this paper about Malinche. And it's like my heart started pounding, and I was like, I had this visceral response to hearing her story because it felt familiar. And I go, what? Why is this? I don't even know who this person is. And that really was, I think as writers too, and I teach this way too, is that I feel like our bodies know things before we do. So if you think about that, the site of Malinche's betrayal is actually the site of sex, That's what it is. That's what had resonance for me as a young woman, because of really feeling, you know, like I was raised very traditionally. I went to Catholic schools, you know, and have a huge family. But that idea that, you know, men could do whatever they wanted and there wasn't any accountability around their sexualities. But for us as women, it was like, you know, it was still the period where virginity is at a, you know, premium, you know, mm-hmm. and it's like all of those kinds of questions.
And that reflects on the people around you, that your own sexual choices would mean something about your family or about your whole culture.
Exactly.
Your whole nation.
Yes. Yeah, it's a lot of weight.
Right. Well, this particular play, the way that it toggles back and forth between time periods and looks at the different cultural forces that we're born into, I think it's a really beautiful way of showing that, showing how the history lives in all of the experiences that we have right now, that we can't, in a way, we can't escape where we came from and how those forces are shaping us. And I think in the play, it's ultimately, I feel, an uplifting sort of message. Do you personally feel optimistic about our cultural ability to overcome colonialism and our history of violence?
Well,
that's a big question.
Of course I do. You know, I mean, it's like, I mean, how, I mean, it's almost like given the times, you know, and given the even the most recent, you know.
I mean, there's a lot that recently happened. That yes. is kind of pointing maybe in the other direction.
It's totally going backwards. Absolutely.
Yeah.
yeah. But, you know, I don't, I mean, I think that as artists, you know, like there's no room for cynicism. As artists, they're just, I mean, I do, I see sometimes when I look at sort of what sort of makes it in the world, you know, kind of an, you know, art practice, pretty like thinking of visual art, and it's like kind of this sort of white patriarchal cynicism is that's cool, that's cutting edge, that's all of that, you know. And we can't, we, you know, as people of color cannot afford to be cynical, you know. It is, so you have to have like tenacious faith, you know, that things change. And the play really points to it. I mean, one of the last things that Malinche says that she thanks her for being relieved of her burden, you know, and that's a 500-year burden, right? So one hopes in the act of making art that you are, I think the only thing I care about is that consciousness gets raised, you know? So if anybody in that audience just finds that they can find themselves in that story and they don't have to be Mexican to do that. The irony about mathematics is that it's really funny. I mean, people are laughing through the whole thing, you know, like that. And so I think, you know, like when people laugh too, it's just, it's such a liberation, you
That's
know.
That's an like, opening.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That was Cherie Moraga talking with KALW's Jen Chien. You can see The Mathematics of Love yourself at the Brava Theater in San Francisco until August 27th. All that information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The Sons of Soul Revivers is a San Francisco-based quartet whose members come from a family of gospel singers, and their songs are grounded in the gospel tradition. But their taste isn't exclusively tied to religious music. They take inspiration from everyone from the True Tones to the Jackson Five. They say their style is right between old-timey and contemporary, but they keep their message simple. Their identity is with the church. The Morgan brothers, James, Walter, and Dwayne, came into KALW studios to talk about carrying their simple message through song.
It's a needed time. It's a needed time. Oh, yes, it is. It's a needed time.
Well, the Sons of the Soul Revivers, our mission is to help bring the gospel to a dying world. And in the gospel, like you must hear a preacher to be saved, but hearing a gospel song will help direct you in that path and put something on your mind. The Soul Revivers were formed by my father, Deacon Walter Morgan Sr., along with different members that came from another group called the True Tones. And that was back in the 50s. And as time went, being that we would go to a lot of programs and watch our father sing, and we were always kind of musically inclined. So in 1970, I myself and a couple of cousins, we decided we wanted to sing. And we decided to form a group. We couldn't come up with a name right away. So my other cousin said, well, since we're the Sons, let's call ourselves the Sons of the Soul Revivers, which at the time made no sense. But it was something to get started with. We stuck with it, made something of it. Being that we come from a Christian-based family, we were always at church, you know, singing in choirs and everything. And my father being a quartet, you know, gospel quartet singer himself. And my mother also was a songstress with a group back in the day. So once you're around something and it kind of, you'll catch on to it. My idol as a child, as a guitar player, was Mr. Tito Jackson. I loved the way he played. And sometimes, you know, I can use a lick that might come from that era, you know, but I'll use it and twist it into a gospel tune. Yeah.
I've been shook by. The song Shook that Dwayne wrote, if you listen to this one part, they infused the lick from the Isley Brothers' It's Your Thing. I don't have no doubt in my mind that being musically inclined and educating yourself with music will help you to become a better artist all the way around. But the main thing is we don't lose focus on the message. That's, I think, the most important part for me, being a member of the Sons of the Soul Revivers, is that we keep the message straight, forward, and simple. When you see us in concert, you're going to get the real deal. The excitement that I get right before they call our name, I mean, it's like a little nervousness, but as soon as they say the Sons of the Soul Revivers, oh, all that is gone. And where were the time limit? 30 minutes, 45, hour, whatever. We're going to give it to you, and it's going to be real. What he done for me? Listen, I get joy when I think about, I said, what he's done for me? What does joy mean? It's an indescribable feeling.
To be able to talk to people, your neighbors, you know, to be able to walk outside and just to breathe the air.
It illustrates my personal feelings, my relationship with Christ.
The Bible said that the joy of the Lord is your strength. And for us as believers, that's what we believe in.
Where nothing that happens in your life will make you want to throw in the towel. People don't get it sometimes, you know, when you're unemployed, you know, you've been laid off your job, your mortgage is due, you know, your children are hungry, and all these things are going against you, but for some reason, you still have hope. We're like any other family. You know, sometimes you look at a family and you just, you know, on the outside looking in, and you say, oh, what a perfect family. But on the inside, it's just chaos. Here we go. As for me and my house. However, though, at the end of the day, we learn how to compromise. I can truly say that I am happy, I am blessed, and I am privileged to be a small part of this group. And I've been in the group 44 years. And God willing, I'll be in the group 44 more years. I don't know. I just feel good about where we're going.
That was the San Francisco Gospel Quartet, the Sons of Soul Revivers. That piece was produced by KALW's Jackie Sajiko with help from Devin Strolovich. You can catch them at the Sonoma County Blues Festival. That's this Saturday in Rohnert Park. For more details, go to our website, kalw.org, and click Cross Currents.
Triangles of pain, the church I realize.
And that's all for us today. Our team includes Andy Bosselman, Nina Gensler-Debs, Gabe Graben, Sonia Hudson, Raquel Maria Dillon, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, and Laura Wenis. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by a pair of Oakland rappers known as Los Racas. Los Racas is one of the bands performing at this weekend's Art and Soul Festival in downtown Oakland. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Seductiva, la tipa es una diva, tú la tienes que ver pa' creer.